British Spy Stories, Season 2, The Kill Order. Episode 3. It had been threatening to rain before Sir Bernard had left Vauxhall Cross. His dark blue Jaguar Sentinel is stuck in traffic around Parliament Square on the short journey to the white stuccoed building next to No. 10 Downing Street that contains the British Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. His driver, Percy, asks if Sir Bernard would like him to use the bus lanes, as they are allowed to do so in emergencies. Sir Bernard declines the offer, as he doesn't approve of overt shows of privilege. Eventually, Percy pulls up at the road entrance of the ministry and waits while the officer on duty checks the paperwork. Once through the outside gates, Percy parks up and walks around the car to open the door for his boss. On the second floor, Sir Bernard is shown into a dark oak-panelled meeting room with a view over Whitehall. Within 30 seconds, a door opens at the far end of the room.
"Bernard, good to see you."
The man walks quickly and offers his hand.
"Ralph, how are you?"
"Good, good,"
says Sir Ralph Coltrane, looking intensely at Sir Bernard. The words leave Sir Bernard with a feeling that there was more that Ralph was going to say, but decided not to at the last moment. Sir Ralph Coltrane is tall and thin, his expensive suit hiding a wiry frame that can be seen jogging along Whitehall each lunchtime, from Parliament Square to Trafalgar Square, then back through Admiralty Arch and past the Churchill War Rooms. He has a broad, open face, salt and pepper hair cut short, and royal blue eyes with lids that blink just more often than most people's do. He is the permanent secretary to the Foreign Office, the most senior civil servant in the ministry, responsible for managing the relationship with the Foreign Secretary, whose role includes responsibility for MI6 and the listening station, GCHQ, but oddly, not the domestic service, MI5.
"I've been meaning to arrange a lunch for us," says Sir Ralph. "But diaries, you know."
They both smirk knowingly at the most common excuse there is to not meet someone.
"Sit, sit."
Sir Ralph pulls out one of the 10 chairs that are pushed under a mahogany table that dominates the room. They both sit down and a man in a dark suit brings in a tray with tea in a pot and a plate of biscuits.
"Thank you, Richard,"
says Sir Ralph, then waits until the man has left and the door closes behind him.
"I wanted to get you in for a chat about this scientist chap."
"Morrison,"
says Sir Bernard.
"We now have one of the world's leading biological weapons experts hidden away in Denmark,"
says Sir Ralph.
"The Russians, whose company he was enjoying until last week, are not best pleased that we have their chap. Question one is, will they do anything about it?"
"Highly likely," says Sir Bernard.
"What?"
"Snatch him back, possibly. Or take one of our assets if they can't locate Morrison."
"And we have good people looking after him?"
"Naturally."
"What about them snatching someone else?"
asks Sir Ralph.
"All of our assets are constantly monitored."
"Could they retaliate against the agent who grabbed him?"
"Potentially. It was one of our best European field ops people. They'll know who she is, as she didn't eliminate the security around Morrison, so they would have ID'd her."
"Does she need pulling out of the field?"
"She can look after herself."
"When do you move Morrison?"
says Sir Ralph.
2 or 3 weeks."
"I need to brief the minister. She'll want to know accurate timings."
"I can't give you anything more accurate yet, Ralph. It depends on many factors, mostly relating to Morrison's safety."
"Understood,"
says Sir Ralph. Then he pauses.
"This one is top priority, Bernard."
"Meaning?"
"The minister's meeting the Yanks next week. She wants to give them commitments."
"To what exactly?" says Sir Bernard.
"Cooperation across a range of initiatives, including this Morrison thing."
I'm not sure I understand you, Rob. We have the man. We'll move him into US hands as and when it's safe to do so, under our agreed safety protocols for moving high-value civilian assets.
The Yanks are nervous?
About what?
Morrison?
Sir Bernard, who is beginning to get irritated at Coltrane's questions, shifts in his seat.
Ralph, you can assure the minister, and she can assure the Yanks, that our best people are on this, he says. The agent who snatched Morrison will oversee the transfer. She's a one-woman army, if needs be, and Morrison will be treated as an utmost priority.
Thank you, Bernard.
There's an uncomfortable pause between the men, with Sir Bernard still unclear what the other man was really getting at. They talk for another half an hour on other issues. Then Sir Ralph has to go. As he leaves, Sir Bernard can't help thinking that there is some sort of plan in flight about Morrison that Ralph hasn't been totally open about. The Ivy Restaurant in Wimbledon sits at the top of Wimbledon Hill, in what the locals call the village. Expensively dressed women inhabit the cafes and the restaurants in the village at all times of the year, apart from the tennis fortnight, when the place is overrun with tennis fans and the locals are absent, having rented their houses out to players at exorbitant rates. Ella is early and is shown to a table at the far end of a broad room that gives a view of the garden beyond. The place is half full, and the gentle buzz of conversation gives the impression of discreet gentility. A woman approaches the table. She is in her 40s. Her brunette hair is curly and pushed back behind her ears. Under her open camel coat, she wears a dark blue suit.
Hello, Ella.
She holds out her hand.
Marjorie Allardyce.
Ella stands to shake hands, and they both sit.
I haven't been here before.
No, nor me,
says Ella.
Isn't it just up the road from your flat? Just not the sort of place I eat normally, she says. I'm more pubs and pizza.
A waitress approaches. Marjorie already knows what she's having without looking at the menu, and Ella feels the pressure of the woman watching as she decides.
How long have you been with us now?
Says Marjorie, both of them aware that their conversation will have to be guarded in a public place.
6 years. A head of research after 6 years. Impressive.
Ella smiles.
Cambridge, wasn't it? Yes, Girton. And a first in modern history. Enjoy it. Yes,
says Ella, wondering where this is going.
Why did you choose us for a career? I like research. I saw an advert. Nothing weird.
Marjorie watches the younger woman.
Tell me about Stefan, she says with a smile. We met a few weeks ago.
Where?
A pub. He approached you.
Marjorie pulls apart a bread roll on her side plate and butters it.
Yes, he approached me.
Ella's pupils are large, she is aware, but she doesn't want to look guilty of anything.
Does that happen to you a lot?
Says Marjorie.
You're a pretty girl. Male attention?
Says Ella.
I guess. Why didn't you send in the 3P? I wasn't sure the relationship would go anywhere. That's not the rule. I know.
Ella's emotions rise in her voice.
Did you send it in after we spoke yesterday?
Says Marjorie.
Not yet. You said you wanted to talk. Here's what I think. I can help you here. As you haven't declared the relationship, it will look suspicious now. So I'd advise you not to say anything. And I won't either. But what if Stefan really is part of the Moldovan Security Service?
She says, whispering.
I can keep that off any official records, says Marjorie. Why would you? You remind me of how I was in my 20s. I made mistakes. And in this business, those mistakes go on your record, and you can never shake them off. You're a high flyer. This could affect your whole career. And we need more women higher up, in both of our organisations. I don't want to break the rules. It's not breaking the rules. No one will know. But we can use this situation to our benefit. What do you mean? It gives us access to Moldovan intelligence, says Marjorie. Her eyes are unblinking and locked onto Ella's face. I don't understand. If Stefan does have access to the Moldovan intelligence network, we can use that opportunity to benefit us both. Ella says nothing, and then their food arrives. Marjorie diverts the conversation to a comparison of their childhoods, which runs throughout the main course. Then they order coffees. The topic we were talking about earlier, says Marjorie. Before we do anything, let me have some conversations. I'll explore his background, and if there's anything valuable we need from him. She stops and inserts a reassuring smile at Ella. I want to help, and I don't want to see a great career ruined from one silly mistake. Agent Carling sits with his feet up on the windowsill of the third floor flat of 32A Overgarten Oven Vandit. The street runs along the canal bank that connects at both ends to the main Copenhagen harbour waterway. He leans forward and flicks the ash off his cigarette and out of the open window as his eyes trace the rooftops of the Christianshavn district of central Copenhagen that lays beneath him. He likes this area as it's full of hip cafes and vegetarian restaurants, and it frustrates him that his ward, Professor Michael Morrison, cannot venture out more than once a day to take in the richness of the surrounding area, and even then, only for 30 minutes, to avoid being too conspicuous. Carling has a round, boy-like face, with a moustache and eyes set close together, all surrounded by light brown hair in a ponytail. London Centre encourages their agents to blend in with the area they're allocated to, and Carling's patch is Denmark and Sweden. He felt it only fitting to grow his hair long, which his mother had described as full-on hippie when he saw her a few weeks ago on a visit home to Norfolk. This babysitting job is not the sort of thing he ever likes doing as part of his duties. He'd rather be out doing some undercover work or real spying than looking after some old man. But the prof, as he started to call him, is all right. They have kept their brains alert by playing cards and chess every evening. The prof sleeps late, but is a good cook. And they have been enjoying long lunches to pass the time. Their daily walk is due any minute. Morrison likes to keep to a timetable, like he does when doing research work. Morrison appears in the doorway behind Carling.
Francis,
he says, using Carling's cover name.
Time for our daily sojourn.
Right you are, Prof, he says. He throws the butt of his cigarette out of the window, grabs his coat from a hook behind the door, and the two of them make their way down to street level. They have been walking for 10 minutes before Carling becomes aware that they have a tail. He directs the prof around a couple of corners to check the stickiness of the tail, and the man follows their path, albeit 100 yards behind them. As they pass a cafe, Carling suggests they stop for a coffee, and they go in and sit at a table by the window so that Carling can have a good view of the street outside. Morrison is unaware of anything untoward, and Carling wants to keep it that way. They order drinks and chat about the state of research in the West versus China. By the time they finish their coffees, Carling has seen no sign of the tail again, but tells the prof to stay seated for a minute while he goes out to check something. Carling walks out into the Copenhagen day. The sun has broken through the clouds, and it feels warm on his face. He turns right out of the cafe and scans the faces along the street as he goes. Suddenly, he sees the tail again. Near the entrance to an alleyway between two tall buildings. The guy slips out of sight, and Carling walks towards the alley and looks down the passage. As he does so, he sees the man go through a gate at the far end. Carling runs towards him, but the man stays put and turns a key in a lock on the gate before Carling reaches the fence.
"Too late, Agent Carling," he says,
then turns and disappears around the corner. Carling tugs at the gate, then looks up at the fence, but it's 8 foot high, and decides not to climb up. What did the guy mean? Too late? Carling turns back up the alleyway. Then, his brain catches up. He starts to run, turns the corner, and arrives at the cafe. There's a crowd of people in the doorway.
"Move aside, please! Move aside, police!"
he shouts. Then, he sees Morrison. The old man is lying across the table, with a bloodstain seeping into the fabric on the back of his jacket.